There's a lot I have to say regarding giftedness and the things in my life that are directly or indirectly related to which, in my view, is everything.
Hello, and welcome to the International Gifted Consortium. I'm Vanessa Wood. We hear real-life stories daily from our communities, from our schools, and from our families across the globe, both heartwarming and heart-wrenching. In order to truly understand our highly and profoundly gifted population, we have to go beyond our own experiences to the depths of another's reality. In each episode, we'll give you a glimpse into the life. So sit back, embrace the space, and take in the view. From the eyes of the highly profoundly gifted, this is Room with a View. Welcome. So glad you're here. We continue to be inspired by your feedback and greatly appreciate you sharing this education outreach podcast with your friends, family, colleagues, and clients too. Recently, many of you described the profound effect an episode had on your life or life view. Thank you for sharing with us. Our goal is for all stakeholders across all disciplines to gain an awareness and, even better, an understanding. Giftedness does not just exist in the classroom. Giftedness is a human development experience that spans the lifespan. Today, Dr. Matthew Zakreski, clinical psychologist and founder of the Neurodiversity Collective, joins us to talk about overexcitabilities. His work spans the continuum of giftedness, working with both gifted and highly profoundly gifted children and adolescents. Today, we are going to focus on the unique differences he has observed in his work with the highly profoundly gifted. Dr. Zakreski, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us. In our previous conversation, I appreciated how you distinguish overexcitabilities into three categories: those individuals who exhibit one or two overexcitabilities, those individuals who experience overexcitabilities from environmental triggers, and those individuals who experience overexcitabilities all of the time. Can you tell us more?
Hello, my name is Dr. Matt Zakreski, and I am a clinical psychologist on the East Coast of the United States, currently outside Philadelphia, who specializes in working with gifted and twice exceptional students. I'm so excited to be on this podcast. This is one I've followed for quite some time, and it seems really cool that I get to be on it. So let's dive right in. If we're talking about overexcitabilities, I think for me the biggest thing is accepting a baseline of what it is and what it means to be gifted and neurodiverse. Gifted and neurodiverse individuals are more intense. They're bigger feelings, more energy, longer, louder talking, all that good stuff. If we think about what overexcitabilities are, it's like they're areas where we can receive but also transmit more information, right? So it's the sort of thing that nobody likes a room that's too cold, right? I'm sitting here wearing a sweater and on my comfy chair, and I've got a blanket next to me and a cup of hot tea because I'm a little too cold today, but I'm able to manage that. There are some people for whom that a room that's a little bit too cold is so overwhelming that they can't, and they can't whatever we want them to do, right? Or maybe it's scratchy socks, or maybe it's too salty of food. It's not only receiving more sensory input, but then also expressing it. And the expression of that overexcitability sometimes can be harder to see, right? Because sometimes it's overt, but oftentimes, especially with the gifted population, which tends to be more introverted, you're going to see more and more kids who internalize that stuff, who hold on to it. So we have to watch out for our internalizing kids and really get to know them in terms of what their triggers are, what bothers them, in addition to what makes them feel good. And the way that overexcitabilities can manifest in a positive or a preferred way is an important thing to keep in mind because, like many things, we tend to focus on overexcited abilities when they interrupt learning or functioning, or when they make our kids upset, angry, or anxious. And obviously, we have to pay attention to those things, right? I'm not saying not. But remember, overexcited abilities can make us happy.
Absolutely. That's such an important point, Dr. Sekreski. Overexcited abilities do make people happy. In fact, the expression itself is fueled by positive energy. Often, I'm told it's the squandering or negative reactions of others that doesn't feel so good. Being told to calm down seems to be a popular one. Often, it seems to be a response during activities that you might actually expect would excite someone or warrant energy and enthusiasm. So the reaction can be confusing, especially to a child that is very engaged in the activity at hand. Students have told me they've been told to calm down by a teacher when they were singing, brainstorming, or even telling a story. I know these are examples of more extroverted expressions, but there are certainly plenty of introverted expressions as well. Can you give us some more examples of greater than typical sensitivity, intensity, and awareness that you've observed or discussed with the highly profoundly gifted children you have worked with?
One of the kids that I worked with, he had a major sensory overexcited ability where he liked head squeezes. You know, give me a big head squeeze. Now, you can imagine that's not something that always plays super well in a school or with people, and sometimes even with his own family. But this is something that really worked for him. So what we were able to do was to work with him to find ways that he could do different, that he could give himself that kind of squeeze that was not disruptive to the classroom, that was something that he could do quietly that wasn't so dramatic. And it ended up being a hat with a really adjustable brim that he could make super tight, and that gave him enough of the sensation to help him re-regulate when he needed it. Now, this is one of the ones that sticks out because it was a little bit more unusual, right? But it, to me, it's also this idea that OEs can show up in so many different ways, that we need to be open and honest and curious when we're connecting with our kids around these issues. Another example that comes to mind of a profoundly gifted kid with overexcited abilities was, and I love this story, so this young woman I worked with had a serious intellectual overexcited ability around chess. Now, many gifted and profoundly gifted kids enjoy chess, so that on the surface wasn't terribly typical, but what she would do is she was really going through the strategy of playing chess almost all the time in her brain. So she would be in history class and she would be sketching out, you know, ideas about different chess moves. And because she wanted to stay relatively engaged in what the classroom content was, she would name her characters after what was going on in history class. So, you know, in the Franco-Prussian War, my knights are these people, my king is this person, my queen is this person, my pawns are these people. And then on the other side, you know, this is the Prussian side. So this is the Prussian general, this is the Prussian soldier. And it became this sort of beautiful way for her to understand it. But it also was really frustrating for her teachers to try to understand. And it took a lot of intervention from, and I was a member of a team on this one, to help them understand that she wasn't being disrespectful, sending everything through the lens of chess. It was helping her to understand it because, you know, what we know about learning theory and memorization theory is that throwing things through a structure, a filter, actually engages comprehension and repetition because you're putting context to it. You're building a scaffold. So, you know, yeah, I guess nobody thought in their Ed 101 class in college that they were going to have to diagram Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn through the lens of high-level chess. At the same time, if you open your heart and your mind to it, you can't say that her plan didn't make sense. And isn't that sort of the beauty of education, that the ability to connect one thing to another thing can lead to explorations and insights that we wouldn't have otherwise considered?
Thank you for sharing those authentic examples. We know from the IGC literature review of highly profoundly gifted students and overexcitabilities that sensual and psychomotor overexcitabilities actually enhance intellectual, imaginational, and emotional overexcitabilities at the higher developmental levels. So in the case with the highly profoundly gifted boy who needed head squeezes, and considering he was in the appropriate environment, this overexcitability likely enhanced or propelled his intellectual, imaginational, and/or emotional overexcitability, which I think is such an important point for our audience to hear. And what a beautiful example of the combination of higher level intellectual, imaginational, and emotional overexcitabilities in the girl who created her own history lesson through her immense understanding and love for chess. So, Dr. Zakreski, how do you see understanding and providing for highly profoundly gifted students given our current school systems?
In terms of thinking about how the highly profoundly gifted fit into broader society, especially educational systems, it is really important to think about the normal curve. And I often think about the normal curve to put highly profoundly gifted kids in context to their peers that are both neurotypical and also their other gifted peers. Now, the American education system, right, is built to teach to the middle. So the middle in the normal curve is this big, beautiful 68% of kids, and most educational strategies are get the biggest bang for your buck if you're teaching to the middle. And if we take one more standard deviation out to either side, so we're going to right up to the edge of gifted to down towards moderate learning disability, you know, a minor adaptation to your core content is going to catch those kids as well. So the vast majority of learners, right, 96%, can be taught through typical education techniques with minor alterations. Now, obviously, I'm being a little bit overly generalized here, but the theory matters. And then we have our gifted kids that start at 130, and then we have our 145, then our 160, then our 175, right? And as we move out into profoundly and exceptionally gifted, you know, there's this idea that what works for a gifted kid at 130 would work for a gifted kid at 150 or 173 or et cetera, et cetera. And that same idea, that same thought process about the normal curve holds, because just like we would need to do wildly different things for a gifted kid at 130 as opposed to a neurotypical student at an IQ of 100, then we would have to do wildly different things for a profoundly gifted kid at 160 IQ than we would at a gifted kid at 130. Now, there's nothing bad about this, but it means that we just need to constantly look at the lens of how far are we away from what the system is designed to give us. And since the system is designed to give us the biggest bang for the buck, the 68% in the middle, you know, a kid with a 173 IQ is a unicorn, right? There might be 50,000 of those kids on the planet. So we need to think about how do we build a system to give that kid what they need. Another thing that happens when kids are that far out in terms of standard deviation is they don't look or act like most of the kids we see, right? And if most of the kids we see who are neurotypical are look and act a certain way, kids who are neuroatypical or neurodivergent are going to not look and act like other kids. They're not going to connect socially. They're not going to have the same interests. They're not going to emote. They're not going to communicate. And those differences can be very off-putting for teachers and mental health professionals, not to mention parents. So part of this broader approach is the psychoeducation piece, is understanding what you're dealing with and why that matters, right? Why these differences exist and how they show up. And I share this because it's the sort of thing that even though the further we move out onto the normal curve, there are fewer and fewer kids statistically, they still deserve good interventions. They still deserve us to understand them. So we have to understand the needs of a profoundly or exceptionally gifted child just as we would a child who's neurodivergent with a learning disability or someone who's neurotypical. And I think that oftentimes profoundly gifted kids get lost in the wash.
Unfortunately, that's true. Historically, highly profoundly gifted kids have gone, as you say, lost in the wash. That's why we're here and why we are so grateful to be having this conversation with you. The IGC exists to provide research and education outreach specific to this population that is often overlooked because of underachievement and or improper social environmental influences, or unidentified and or misdiagnosed due to a lack of training on the characteristics, behaviors, and development typical of this population. How do you overcome these challenges in your work?
Probably the most common way that this becomes an issue is in the question of autism spectrum disorder. And I want to start by saying that there is nothing wrong with being on the autism spectrum, right? Autism is a different brain, just like giftedness is a different brain. And you can certainly be on the autism spectrum and also be gifted, profoundly gifted. We call that twice exceptional, which I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast, you already know that term, but it's always good to make sure we're starting at the same place. Now, one of the things that we know about the gifted brain and the autism brain is that they're very similar. There's a lot of stuff in common. And the differences in sort of parsing out a differential diagnosis, it's a very nuanced process. And I speak with several providers on a weekly basis in my job who struggle with this differential. And it's the sort of thing where if you are a profoundly gifted child, you are very different to the point of 4 or 5 standard deviations to what we consider typical, that a lot of your essence, how you talk, how you think, how you interact, how you emote, how you connect with peers and teachers and parents is very different, different to the point that maybe other people have never seen it before. So one of the terms that gets used a lot in schools and systems when kids are very different is autistic, more colloquially, spectrumy, right? And once that label gets attached to a kid, it can be very difficult to shake it, because once again, you know, difference tends to get pathologized in our system. And that's obviously unfair, but it is a reality of the system. And when you have a kid who's quirky, when you have a kid who's different, then sometimes providers don't think to use an IQ test as a way of differentiating that. They'll say, okay, well, the referral question is a question of autism, so I'm going to assess for autism, and this very profoundly gifted kid who's quirky and doesn't emote or talk or connect like I expect a kid to, well, all of the things sure look like autism, so I'm going to diagnose this kid with autism. And that may be a correct diagnosis, right? We don't know this theoretical child. But unless we're using an IQ test as a further lens to observe the child's behavior, then we're potentially missing out on something vital. My best example of this is a young woman I worked with. Her IQ was in the high 160s. And the first time I met her, I thought to myself, this kid has inattentive type ADHD. Now, when we think about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, we tend to think of the hyperactive type, the running around the room, throwing things, impulsive, falling out of the chair, etc., etc., etc. Now, that's certainly a great description of that type of ADHD. But the other type of ADHD could easily be described as hidden, because inattentive type, it isn't big behaviors, and big behaviors tend to get noticed. It's head in the clouds, disorganized, daydreaming, lost in thought. And if you're a bright kid, and especially if you're a bright girl, that kind of behavior can slide you under the radar. Now, you combine that sort of inattentive type ADHD presentation with a 160-something IQ, you realize pretty quickly that young woman was skating by, getting mostly A's, the occasional B+, not because she was paying attention. She was creating worlds in her brain. I mean, she had created an entire fictitious universe that had sort of a combination of Aquaman and Thundercats, which, frankly, if it was on TV, I would watch it. But that was what she was doing with her time. And the teachers would ask her questions and she would give an answer. And the answer was almost always accurate because she either A, already knew it, or B, could figure it out from context clues. So people just let her keep doing what she was doing. And it wasn't until school got harder for her in middle school, seventh grade, when I started seeing her. And it looked like a pretty typical ADHD inattentive type case, right? And we had referred out to the school district for an IQ test just as sort of a pro forma thing, like, let's make sure we're covering all our bases here. And the school psychologist contacted me and said, so she broke the scale. I don't have the extended norms, so I had to stop testing her. And so then I was able to help out with the extended norm testing, which I say her IQ was in the 160s, because we certainly got a number, and that number is fine, but I think we left some points on the table in the way we administered the test. But it's another example of just how easy it is to miss these kids, how the systems are not prepared to deal with them through no fault of anybody's own, you know. But it means that we need to be able to pivot into where can we get the resources when we need them.
The IGC calls this pivot a paradigm shift. We need to take the knowledge we have, the research, and what we know about the highly profoundly gifted and move to better understanding and identification. Only then can we provide the proper educational and developmental support needed by our highly profoundly gifted students. Dr. Zakreski, we are so appreciative to you for sharing your understanding and your work with the highly profoundly gifted. I would like to end by reiterating some of your on-target insights, starting with just how easy it is to miss these kids. With an open heart and mind and curiosity, we can begin to notice the many ways that overexcitabilities show up. The highly profoundly gifted are wildly different, and we need to realize just how far they are away from what the system is designed to give, and build a system that gives these kids what they need. They too deserve good interventions and understanding. Education outreach and training is essential, especially for our parents, teachers, school administrators, counselors, and psychologists. Stakeholders need to be able to identify not only the characteristics, behaviors, and development of typical children, but also atypical, neurodivergent, highly profoundly gifted children. Thank you for your wise words, Dr. Zakreski, and thank you to our loyal audience and supporters from around the world. Room with a View is produced by the International Gifted Consortium Education Outreach Initiative for you and by you. Join us on social media, giftedconsortium.org, or connect with me on LinkedIn. And please join us in celebrating 5 years. Go to giftedconsortium.org and consider making a donation. 100% of donations received go towards our education outreach programs and our upcoming research study of overexcitabilities in highly profoundly gifted children. Please join in and make a difference. Until next time, enjoy the view.